I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. While the fighting in Syria has subsided in parts of the country, civilians are still paying a heavy price. Yesterday, three airstrikes on a market in Atareb killed 61 people. That's according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. The town is located in an area that's designated a de-escalation zone. The civil war began some 6 years ago, killing hundreds of thousands of men, women, and children, forcing millions of flee their homes looking for a safer life inside and outside the country. We're going to hear about Syrian refugees a little bit later in the hour. But first, we ask Karim Shaheen to join us. He reports on Turkey, the Middle East, including Syria for The Guardian. And he joined us by Skype from Istanbul. Karim Shaheen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us anything more about these airstrikes in this market and these 61 people who were killed?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, this is an area that's supposed to be covered by a de-escalation agreement. It's an agreement between Russia, Turkey, and Iran that was supposed to, reduce the violence across Syria in order to, pave the way for a political settlement, for some sort of deal to be agreed between all the powers that are vying for control in Syria, which was why, it was really surprising for this attack to happen. But, as you said, there are over 60 people who were killed in the airstrikes, but there are tens of thousands of others around the country who are still living in besieged and hard-to-reach areas, and they're also suffering, and their suffering tends to not get as much attention as the airstrikes that occur and the immediate violence that we see on a day-to-day basis.
And I do want to get to the other parts of the country, but do we know who's responsible for these airstrikes?
Well, the area is controlled by the opposition. It's run by a local governing council, which are these governing bodies that have been set up by the opposition in places that they control and where the majority of the people living there are civilians. And it's not entirely clear why it was bombed. The obvious conclusion to come to it is that either the government of Bashar al-Assad or their Russian allies carried out the bombing, but there's no immediate indication of which one of the two was responsible for it.
Amnesty International came out with a report, I believe, yesterday, frankly blaming both sides for a number of human rights violations, but essentially calling out the Assad regime as being the biggest offender. What are some of these human rights violations that are happening today in Syria?
Yeah, so the Amnesty report that came out yesterday was focused on addressing the sieges that are taking place around Syria. This has been a phenomenon of the crisis since, at least 2012. There are about 500,000 Syrians living in these hard-to-reach or besieged areas around the country. The Assad government has maintained a strategy since the conflict began of surrounding and attempting to starve various areas that are controlled by the opposition in an effort to get them to surrender, essentially, to give up their fight and to, reach some sort of reconciliation deal by which most of the opposition fighters will leave and go to some other place, and the area will fall back under government control. So they've succeeded in doing so in several different regions around the country, including four areas that were described in the Amnesty report. So the violations that take place include essentially depriving the civilians living in those areas of food, essential medicine, other health supplies. We reported last month on the case of a girl living in an area called East Ghouta, where blockade has been ongoing for several years and was tightened earlier in April. And she was a one-month-old baby who died because she starved to death, and her mother was unable to breastfeed her because her mother herself was starved and so was unable to provide her with any milk.
This was a baby named Sahar?
Absolutely, yeah.
And she died, about a month ago or so?
Yeah, so the pictures emerged of her being weighed on a scale last month, and she was a one-month-old baby, and her mother was unable to feed her, to breastfeed her, because her mother was herself malnourished, and so she wasn't able to nurse. And we've been reporting on these sieges for a very long time, and the suffering is extremely palpable among the people who live in those areas. I mean, most of the time they have to resort to, you know, gathering leaves and grass and cooking it with spices, or, you know, in boiled water with spices in order to, you know, feed their children or add some flavor to whatever sustenance they can get.
Isn't this a war crime to target civilians, to withhold food and medicine from the civilian population?
Absolutely, and the report that Amnesty released yesterday came to the conclusion that it was even worse than a war crime. It was a crime against humanity because it was a systematic attempt deny essential life supplies to civilians in those besieged areas, and then followed by forced displacement through these reconciliation deals. So many of these people are, you know, have really no choice because they feel that they will be punished by the government once it takes control of the area. If they decide to stay, because they'll be punished for living under the opposition for so long. And so many of them give up their homes and give up their life savings and whatever they had after living in Stone Age conditions for, you know, multiple months or possibly years. And then they have to leave and become refugees somewhere else as a consequence of these deals.
As I mentioned, Amnesty International did blame both sides. Are there similar violations by the rebels or the rebel groups who are fighting the Assad regime?
Yes. So the Assad regime has been prosecuting most of the vast majority of the sieges around the country, but there are cases where ISIS maintained a siege of one of the cities in Syria near the Iraqi border for several years as well, and the rebels also carried out a siege of two towns in one of the provinces in Syria. The towns were populated by Shia civilians for the most part. And they were surrounded by the rebels and besieged for several years, and they blocked supplies from coming in, and they also fired indiscriminately into civilian areas in those two towns. So those actions were also labeled war crimes by Amnesty International. The Assad regime's actions were labeled as war crimes and crimes against humanity because of their systematic nature.
You mentioned ISIS. Is there any presence of ISIS in Syria today?
There is. Their presence has really declined very rapidly over the last year. They've lost strongholds in both Iraq and Syria. They're on the run in Syria now. They've lost their de facto capital of Raqqa to a campaign by Kurdish militias backed by the U.S. and the U.S.-led coalition, which drove them out of Raqqa. Some of the fighters, perhaps, you know, up to a few thousand, escaped the city in its last days under a deal negotiated by the militias and ISIS, and escaped out into the desert. They were at the same time being besieged in this area called Deir ez-Zor, which is in the southeastern part of Syria. And they just lost the city a couple of weeks ago, and so they're basically retreating into desert hideouts at this point, into areas near the border, into smaller towns where they can try to attempt to regroup, and this includes both local ISIS fighters from Syria and Iraq, as well as foreign fighters who escaped those towns as well.
Some of the scenes of the devastation in Syria are just extraordinary and heartbreaking. One wonders how anyone survives in that country. Are there, though, parts of Syria that are essentially untouched by this civil war?
The parts of Western Syria which have been in the hands of the regime since essentially the revolution and then the civil war began, many of them are maintaining a relatively normal life. Other than occasional sort of electricity cuts and services shortages and so on. But at the same time, some of those areas, include the coastal areas like Latakia, like Hama, and so on. Some of those towns have been contested in the past. Aleppo, for example, was contested for a very long time. It's Syria's largest city. It was its industrial capital, and it was devastated, for several years because it was split between the opposition and the government, until the government took it back at the end of 2016. Some of those areas that have been under government control since the beginning have not suffered as much as areas that fell under rebel control, mm-hmm. and it was a very deliberate regime strategy, obviously, to make it clear that life would not be possible without the state, and life would not be possible without its control over those areas.
So, can we say the Assad regime is winning this war?
I think it's lurching towards a military victory, but I think it would be wrong to say the Assad regime won the war because, frankly, the reason that the Assad regime has survived for so long is because of its allies, and that includes Hezbollah, the militia organization in Lebanon, which intervened in the war in Syria in 2013. The Iranians themselves have sent a lot of military advisors and militiamen. The Russian government intervened, at the end of 2015 with its air force and the airstrikes conducted by Russia, and the campaign that it and the various campaigns that it assisted the Assad regime with were crucial for its survival. So the Assad regime survives for now, but it's unclear, what shape Syria is going to take if there is a final settlement, on the horizon. Syria right now is divided into basically zones of control by various, by the proxies of various foreign powers that have intervened in the war. And so we don't know what the end game is yet.
Does anyone talk about peace or a peace agreement or a peace deal yet?
There are ongoing efforts to negotiate a peace deal, but the problem is that obviously there are so many different interests. I mean, you've got Russia, you've got the United States, which is more focused on the ISIS and Al Qaeda threat. You've got Turkey, which has sent in rebels that are backed by Turkey, and they control a big chunk of northern Syria today. You've got Hezbollah and the Iranians who are very interested in setting up a different second front against Israel and the potential that there's another war in the region. You've got other Arab countries that had sponsored various militias like Saudi Arabia and Qatar. So you've got a lot of different interests at play there, and that's not to even include the Kurdish movement that's trying to carve out its own space in the midst of all of this.
And just to add to that, we're almost out of time here, Karim, but just to add to that, you have, about 500,000 Syrians killed in Syria. You've got millions of people who are internally displaced. You've got millions of people who have left the country. You've got more than 100,000 detained or disappeared. It's hard to imagine the future for a country that has been so destroyed.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the reconstruction is going to take a very long time and countless amounts of money. And as you said, half the country's population has been displaced. Most of them are inside Syria, but there are over 3 million refugees in Turkey. There's over 1 million refugees in Lebanon. There's over 500,000 refugees in Jordan. And there's over 1 million refugees in Europe, mostly in Germany and in Sweden. And as you said, 500,000 people have been killed, to the point where the UN has stopped counting how many people have been killed. Yeah. I think the one thing we can agree to after 6 years of civil war is that the main people who suffered who've been betrayed by everyone from their local militias to their own government to global powers is the Syrian people.
Well, I hate to end on that note. Karim Shaheen, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And he reports on the Middle East, on Turkey. We've been talking about Syria, reporting for The Guardian, and he joined us by Skype from Istanbul. We're going to take a very short break, and then we've got a guest who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. We're going to hear the voices of Syrian refugees. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Well, as we just heard, the civil war rages on in Syria, and for many years it dominated the news. It seemed that everyone had an opinion about what the Syrian people wanted, but how many of them had actually talked with actual Syrians? Our guest Wendy Perlman interviewed more than 300 displaced Syrians, including parents and children, teachers, doctors, engineers, computer programmers, ex-prisoners, Christians, Muslims, activists, about their lives and their hopes and their fears. Her book is titled We Crossed a Bridge and It Trembled, and it's an eye-opening read about suffering but also about survival. Wendy Perlman is a professor at Northwestern University and joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Wendy, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tell us about the title of this book, We Crossed a Bridge and It Trembled.
So We Crossed a Bridge and It Trembled is literally taken from one of the testimonials. So it's a book of testimonials. The introduction is in my voice, and the rest of it consists of eight parts, which is exclusively a curation of these interviews that I did with Syrians over a four-year period. So the title is taken directly from one of those voices. It's the voice of a man named Enes, who's describing a mass demonstration in the early months of the uprising. This demonstration took place in April 2011. It was the Great Friday demonstration in solidarity with Good Friday and the Easter celebration. And literally, there were so many people that he said, we, this huge crowd, crossed a bridge and it trembled under the weight. So it is was important to me to have words in the title that were taken directly from Syrian's own words. So it's literal, but it's also a metaphor. It's a symbol. In this Syrian conflict, Syrians have crossed many bridges. They've crossed from authoritarianism to revolution, revolution to war. As refugees, they've crossed from the homeland to other countries. And they have trembled under this tumult. And in many ways, the whole world is trembling from the reverberations of the Syrian conflict in so many ways.
Let me pick up on several things. And as someone who interviews people for a living, I'm interested in your interviews and how you conducted them, especially with people who had left their countries. They were obviously dealing with loss, perhaps even traumatic stress, but clearly in some throes of deep despair. How did you approach them? How did you get them comfortable? How did you get them to talk to you?
Yeah, that's a story in its own right. So I began these interviews in 2012. I began in Jordan. I started with the contacts of two Jordanian journalists who connected me to a Syrian man with whom they'd worked. And we hit it off. I gained his trust, and he introduced me to other people. So one key part of the process is that I was always introduced to a new Syrian interviewee from another person of trust, which helps create a space of trust in which people could speak. Another key part is that I speak Arabic, and sometimes I would do the interview in English, most of the time in Arabic, according to the comfort of the interviewee and his or her own choice. And that also created a space of kind of open communication. I couldn't imagine doing these interviews via an interpreter. I was able
too many, to... Too much would be lost, right?
Too much would be lost. And I was also able to look a person in his or her eyes, he or she look at me, and there was that kind of space of intimacy that was created. But again, because I began the interviews in 2012, there was really a different feel at the time. Many of the people I spoke with, although they had suffered, were still optimistic. People had fled, but many were convinced they were going to go home at any moment. The overwhelming majority of people with whom I spoke identify as opposed to the regime of Bashar al-Assad. This is really the voice of the opposition,
sure.
Revolutionary narratives. Most people I talked to thought that at any moment they were going to get the news that the regime had fallen and they were going to go back and their dream of a free Syria would be achieved. So in the beginning, there was a lot of optimism. People excited to tell their stories because in many ways we're remembering decades or a lifetime of fear, of silence, of intimidation. We're feeling like they had the right to talk for the first time and they wanted to talk.
You quote a computer program, a man named Hossam, or I guess it's a man named Hossam.
Yes.
When you meet someone coming out of Syria for the first time, you start to hear the same sentences that everything is okay inside of Syria. Syria is a great country. The economy is doing great. It will take him like 6 months up to 1 year to become a normal human being to say what he thinks, what he feels, and then they'll start whispering. They won't speak loudly. This is too scary. But then they begin to tell you what their life is like and what Syria was like. Did you find that to be true?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love that passage. And he's describing life in Syria before 2011 and Syrians leaving before 2011, that even after many months, they still have this internalized disposition to silence. So for many Syrians, the revolution, the breaking of the barrier of fear in March 2011 was a way of breaking through all of that silence, a way of mustering the courage to speak, to go out and say no, to hear their voices for the first time. So when I began doing interviews, there was still very much that feeling, an eagerness to talk, because there was, was an awareness that for decades people hadn't been allowed to talk.
I'd love to have you read, is it Sala, who's a landscaper?
Yeah, from Rural Dada. This is an interview I did in that first summer in 2012 when I was in Jordan. And Salah said, "We don't have a government. We have a mafia. And if you speak out against this, it's off with you to Beit Khaltu, your aunt's house." That's an expression that means to take someone to prison. It means forget about this person. He'll be tortured, disappeared. You'll never hear from him again.
What should we know about Salah?
Salah, so he's a landscaper. He's someone who made sort of stone fancy gardens and things. So he didn't have much formal education, but saw himself as an artist, but doing something in a practical way. A very dynamic man. I got to know the entire extended family.
You met them in refugee camps, but also at crossing points. Where did you meet these Syrians that you interviewed?
Mm-hmm. So the overwhelming majority of Syrians in the border countries where most Syrian refugees live actually don't live in camps. Something like 90% are urban refugees. So they're renting apartments and houses scattered throughout villages and towns, primarily in Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon. So I made a few visits to the largest refugee camp in Jordan, but otherwise I met people sort of wherever they found, from networks of one person to another, trying to use as many different entry points as I could to different social networks so I could meet a diversity of people. So I met sometimes people in their living rooms, in coffee shops, in offices, in the spaces of everyday life.
You said some of this is edited for readability. Mm-hmm. I understand that. Mm-hmm. But it also raises questions about, are these their words?
Yes, absolutely. So So I would do interviews, and so these really ranged. Sometimes they were sort of more quick, half-an-hour conversations. Sometimes they were group discussions in which several Syrians would talk amongst themselves for several hours. And sometimes there were these long personal testimonials in which I sat with somebody for several hours, sometimes for days. And sometimes I reconnected with the same person years later on a different continent. And many of these people I'm still in touch with. So most times people would allow me to audio record. And then I had an audio recording, usually in Arabic, sometimes in English. So then became the sort of several-step process. I had to transcribe from audio spoken speech to written speech, which is a whole process.
Yes.
Because we speak, even now as I'm speaking, I'm thinking, have I used any punctuation? There's written speech has a certain formality that oral speech doesn't. And then also often the translation from language. So this was a hugely time-consuming task. So I basically hired almost any bilingual assistant I could to help me get all of these transcripts on paper. And then I had basically hundreds of thousands of words of transcripts of conversations. And sometimes a single interview could be dozens and dozens of pages. And it was often nonlinear. And people would start with a moment conversation about current events and then remember something and then move back to the future and then add a detail that was critical for understanding. So in editing, was my mission to always use people's words, but there was often a bit of some rearranging in order to make a more compact, concise, readable chunk of the text without the circularity of speech. So I thought about, in many ways, almost like making a mosaic in that each speech or each testimonial was like a stone, and I had to cut a piece of it, some piece that could stand and be sort of a gem on its own, and then put the pieces together to make a larger picture so the sum was greater than the parts.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Wendy Perlman, and we're talking about her new book. It's titled We Crossed a Bridge and It Trembled, Voices from Syria. These are testimonials based on interviews that she did with some 300 Syrians, who many of whom have left Syria looking for a better life, whether temporary or permanent. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. As you said, this is broken into sections. I'm interested in the uprising, where it started, what people wanted.
Yeah, so the book goes through the step-by-step way the uprising began, and I think captures the tentativeness, the excitement, the anticipation, the doubt, the uncertainty of this moment in early 2011. So in the book describes Syrians first hearing about news that there are protests in Tunisia, an uprising in Tunisia, an uprising in Egypt, and Syrians begin to talk amongst themselves. Mm-hmm. Will it happen here? Maybe yes, maybe no. And then you begin to hear people sort of pushing the boundaries of political permissibility, beginning to talk a bit more openly about politics. Then there's a call on the internet for a Syrian revolution to begin on March 15th. And some people go out and protest on March 15th. There are a few demonstrations that are quickly squashed. Some think that's the end. We had our chance. It came and went. And then in the southern town of Deraa begins this other event of the sort of mythological story people know now of kids who write graffiti on the wall. They're arrested. They're tortured. Their families go to the local chief of police, who's notoriously corrupt and abusive. And he tells this historic line of, you know, go home, forget your children, make new children, and if you don't know how, bring your wives and I'll teach you how.
Oh my goodness.
And that, in the combination of this regional atmosphere, other people planning other protests, all come together to create what becomes the first mass spontaneous street demonstration in Deraa. People begin protesting in a mosque. Others flock through as they see the crowd leaving the doors of the mosque, and becomes a spontaneous large protest. Security forces come. Two people are killed, so they're also the first martyrs of the revolution, and things spread then over space, over time, and become a national revolt.
You talked to an accountant named Shadi. He says, I actually love this. My first demonstration was better than my wedding day. And when my wife heard me say that, she refused to talk to me for a month.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, just a very human moment, yes?
Yes, there are so many. When one thing I love to ask Syrians was, tell me about your first protest, your first demonstration. And people would have tears in their eyes recalling that. People would say things like, it was the best day of my life. It was the first day I felt like a citizen. It was the first time I heard my own voice. People said it taught me what life is about. That moment of, after a lifetime for many, of feeling silence, to be able to go out and speak their voice. That is the beauty of what this moment was all about. And I hope it's not forgotten, because as things get darker and darker, people now see the Syrian war, the Syrian refugee crisis. They forget there was a popular uprising calling for change, for dignity, for freedom. And this is what the voices in this book capture.
Could you read Shireen? She's a mother, and she lived in Aleppo.
Yeah, a mother from Aleppo. And Shireen said, we had gotten used to oppression. It was part of our life, like air, sun, water. We didn't even feel it. Like there's air, but you never ask, where is the air? A lot of people were opposed to the way things were, but no one protested. You just adapted to oppression and rotted along with it. And then, in 1 second, in one shout, one voice, you blow it up. You defy it and stand in front of death. You have an inheritance, and after 30 years, you slam it on the ground and shatter it.
Again, powerful statement there. Who is Shireen?
Shireen is the mother of two. She's originally from Aleppo. She's Kurdish of origin, and she and her family have now moved on to Europe. They live in Austria in a tiny village at the foot of the Alps.
And did you follow their route out of Syria or wherever they were and then to the Alps?
Yeah, I mean, Shireen had a more atypical way they were able to get visas. So she and her family were able to escape the dangerous journey over boat to the Mediterranean, which many other of the interviewees in the book experienced. So people got to wherever they were in all sorts of ways. I talked to people who had spent tens of thousands of dollars for fake visas and passports. One traveling from Lebanon to Kuala Lumpur in order to get to Sweden.
Kuala Lumpur.
In order to get to Sweden. Others, many took the boats. Or one young man hid himself in a truck and traveled by road from Turkey through Bulgaria until he got out of the truck many hours later and discovered that he was in Brussels, I think. So there are many, many journeys that people had. And of course, the journeys getting out of Syria itself were also tremendously littered with danger and peril.
Oh, I can only imagine. Would it be fair to say that the people largely who have gotten out of Syria had some wherewithal or some means, some connections that allowed them to exit?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a range, but for the majority, that's the case, chiefly because it's really expensive to be able to get out of Syria, and then especially then to get onto Europe. At this point, the borders are increasingly closed. Mm-hmm. And sealed. Only those who maybe are able to pay a smuggler to get them over the Turkish border can leave. So those, I think especially the means are required to be able to leave the border countries to Europe, because that's where it's really a matter of having had the funds to be able to go before the borders of Europe largely sealed. But people leaving Syria left at different times. It was an evolving situation, leaving from 2012 to those who can't get out now and are mostly stuck in internally displaced people's
camps. Yeah, which we heard about at the top of the hour. Yeah. You also interviewed an artist named Ashraf. Ashraf says if international powers had intervened at the beginning, it wouldn't have reached this point, or at least if a no-fly zone had been enforced, things wouldn't have gotten so bad. The problem is not that the world did nothing. It's that they told us, rise up, we are with you, revolt. And then he talks about the red lines and President Obama.
Yeah, there's an enormous sense of disappointment, of abandonment even, that comes out throughout the voices. A sense that the international community betrayed its own ideals of freedom and democracy and human rights, that we went out and were faced by bullets and nobody came to assist us. The most basic principles of civilian protection, of responsibility to protect, of never again before atrocities and war crimes like your previous guest was describing. So there was the sense of being abandoned with the international community on so many levels. The sense of disillusionment is palpable.
We're almost having a break here, but do they have a theory why they've been so abandoned?
There are many theories why. There are many theories why. I mean, there's some who have an awareness of the, well, not some, many who have an awareness of the complex geopolitics of the Syrian conflict, of the domestic politics within the United States and of other places, of the precedent of Libya and what that meant for Syria, that many Americans see Syria and intervention in Syria through the lens of the intervention in Afghanistan, in Iraq, which they and I share the view of being incorrect metaphors and lenses through which to understand Syria. Syria is a different scenario. It's not a would not be a case of intervention to make regime of a U.S. imperialist mission for regime change. It's the Syrian people themselves who went out calling for regime change. The question was, do we stand with them or allow them to be killed?
And that's Wendy Perlman, our guest in this hour of Radio Times today. And again, her book is We Crossed a Bridge and It Trembled, Voices from Syria, based on a number of interviews and testimonials that she did over the course of about 4 years with Syrians who had left their country. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and if you're just joining us, we're talking about what Syrians have to say about the crisis in their country. And our guest, Wendy Perlman, spent several years interviewing Syrian refugees from all walks of life who were forced to flee Assad's brutal regime in their country. And she's collected their stories in her new book, We Crossed a Bridge and It Trembled, Voices of Syria. Mm-hmm. And she's a political science professor at Northwestern University. She spent a couple of decades living in and studying the Middle East, and she does speak Arabic as well. And again, you can join us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. What do you want people to come away with once they hear the voices of these Syrian people?
Several things. I hope that these voices can help people understand the Syrian conflict better. As I was saying earlier, now we think we see Syria as a war, as a refugee crisis. We see the destruction. It's difficult to put the pieces together and understand how this conflict began. Remember that it began as a popular uprising, began that it as an uprising against authoritarianism. What was that authoritarian regime like? How did people suffer under it such that they would want to go out and protest in the first place? And also such that going out and protest was really an amazingly heroic achievement against fear, against intimidation. People risked their lives going out simply peacefully to say no, to ask for freedom, to ask for change, for accountability, for rule of law, for basic freedom of expression. And then the regime responded with violence. The opposition eventually took up arms, and things escalated to this brutal, multi-sided war that we have today. So I hope in listening to Syrians' narratives about their lives, we can better understand that evolution and progression, how one step built on the other, but also know what's at stake. What is at the human level? What does it mean to have lived these tumultuous events? I hope when people listen to Syrians' voices, they will look at Syrians and Syrian refugees not with fear, because there's a lot of fear-mongering going around, not with fear, but also not with pity, but with respect as individuals who have shown resilience and strength, who find hope in spite of it all, but who have also suffered tremendously, and that we and as members of the international community, play a role in that suffering. And then I hope that readers and others who listen will ask themselves, what would I have done were I in those shoes? What's my responsibility now before these people who've been abandoned by the international community?
Are you also saying that these people are just like us?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, just like us, just like us, and we can really try to think what we would have done in their shoes.
I'm interested in this fear and pity. I mean, fear for all those stereotypes about Muslims,
yes.
And pity. What pity? Because they've lost so much.
Yeah.
Their life is so hard.
Absolutely. I think there's a lot of representation of refugees in which we see the bodies of masses of people moving, of people in destitute conditions, and people often, it's easy to just think, oh, these poor people, they are such victims. They've suffered so much, which is true. But there's also a lot of strength there. The mustering, the ability to get out of bed every morning, to find food, to find work, to try to put children in school, to find hope when everything around is so bleak, to keep dreaming when dreams have been crushed and attacked. There's a tremendous amount of strength so that we can look at refugees and not simply feel sorry for them, but be inspired by them.
Do they feel like victims? I mean, clearly there's much that they have lost. And as you said, abandoned in many ways by the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think that there is a sense of being victims of injustice, being victims of violence. When there's an aerial bombardment and bombs are dropping on your head in your neighborhood and there's nowhere you can go to hide and people are killed in their homes or walking in the streets or in markets or in schools, that's victimization for sure. But their families who keep on going in spite of it all, there's a lot of resilience there too.
Let me get, looks like Tasneem to join us from Philadelphia. And Tasneem, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, this is Tasneem. I just want to thank your guest very much. And I want to thank you for spending this time talking about the Syrian people.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of what we see today in the news, people don't see us as like normal human beings. They only see it as a news report, only see the numbers. Like, they don't think about it as people who had normal lives before, who had families, who have, like, just like anyone else, we have dreams, hopes, and all. Like, they don't feel what we feel, only they're, like, looking at it as a political thing,
sure.
As a crisis that's just, like, a piece of the news. So I really love that you're bringing it in this way. I loved how you talked about the beginning of the opposition. Like, I remember the first time I spoke out in 2013, it was just a small speaking, and it changed me, really.
Wow. Tasneem, hold on, because I'm sure our guest wants to respond to what you just said there. Yeah. Wendy, anything you want to add to what Tasneem just said?
Well, just thank you so much for calling. I mean, it means so much to hear that voice and know that these voices that I've been describing resonate with you and your experience. But absolutely, every Syrian with whom I've spoken, when they talk about this, that going out and speaking for the first time, it's an experience that's not simply emotional, but transformative. I mean, a turning point of one's life. Is that how you experience?
Yeah, it sounds that way, doesn't it?
Yeah,
it's just amazing.
Just speaking up for the first time, because like after living in fear your whole life, like it's not something that you would consider possible to like to say anything in politics. Like you can never even like consider that.
Well, I appreciate your call to Radio Times and glad you spoke out on Radio Times as well, Tasneem. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And you can call as well. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Let me shift gears here slightly. And you interviewed a former student, a man named Youssef. And he says some interesting things about ISIS. Mm-hmm. And, of course, this is very complicated, but he says ISIS aren't aliens like some people describe them. They're regular people. They're an organization like other organizations. There were so many men ready to fight ISIS, women too. We could have beaten them, but we didn't have enough weapons. No one supported us. Instead, the U.S.-led coalition started bombing, mm-hmm. which raises a whole host of things about ISIS itself and the outside response to it, including the United States.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So that idea of, you know, the international community could have backed us more. We could have fought this evil thing is the same words that people talk about fighting the Assad regime as well. So this sense of, had there been greater intervention and support, you know, people can't fight a military battle without weapons. They can't survive without a protection from aerial bombardment. They can't survive without food when they're being sieged and starved. So there's simply a way that the Syrian people have done all they can. They've fought. They've suffered tremendously, but without aid, without assistance, without some support fighting a more powerful enemy and other forces that are better armed and better fortified and better supported. It's a very unequal fight.
Yeah. I'd love to have you read Imad, a former student from Salamaya.
Yeah. So this gets to the part of the book in which people talk about leaving and fleeing as refugees and their experience as refugees. So this is what Imad said. He said, everyone was saying, just leave, leave, leave. So I left, like everyone else. I didn't even know where I was going until halfway through the journey. I simply moved along with the crowd. The trip took a month and a half. I was thrown in jail in Hungary, but it was like a 5-star hotel compared to my time in our jails in Syria. And by that time, I only wanted a break from walking and somewhere warm to sleep. I don't have any dreams or plans for the future. I hardly think an hour ahead. Return to college? After all those years that I studied and then the revolution started and I couldn't finish and get my degree? I don't have any patience to start again. Besides, even people who have degrees find them worthless once they get here.
So what should we know about Imad?
Yeah. So this is an interview that I did in Berlin in 2016. And it captured a lot of, I think, the sense of directionlessness. In many ways, Imad and others who'd made it to Europe were the lucky ones. The situation is tremendously dire in Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon. Those who were able to get to Europe are in situations where they have greater opportunities to study, to maybe have work retraining, eventually to have a more stable asylum status. But even in spite of that, what Imad was describing is that it doesn't get easier. Yeah. It's not the end of the journey. It's the beginning of a whole new cycle of challenges. And I hear very similar things among the even perhaps luckier Syrian refugees who make it to the United States, considering that we've accepted such small numbers. I mean, they say it's tremendously difficult. So it captures a sense of despair, I think, that many feel, and especially many of this generation. Imad is in his 20s, and there's a whole generation, many refer to it as the revolution generation, young folks in their 20s, maybe in their late teens to early 30s when the revolution began, who protested, who demonstrated, who sometimes were arrested and tortured in prison, who really sacrificed and were you know, on fire with the dream of being able to have a revolution that would bring about a free Syria. And now many grapple with depression, with some even a sense of regret. Many of them wondering.
Regret having left?
No, on sometimes a regret of the revolution itself. One time some people asking themselves, was it wrong that we ever even went out into the streets? So seeing that sense of regret juxtapositioned with the pure euphoria that people describe of having protested, it's really a tremendously a bleak picture. And again, to make us ask how we failed those who sacrificed for the cause of political change.
Let me quote Yasmin, and she says, my three children have become holders of of European nationalities. My oldest son got an invitation to a convention in Sweden. He stayed. He's now in his third year in university. My middle child was invited by a Spanish friend to go to Spain. He became a Spanish citizen is studying there. My daughter got a scholarship to get her master's at Qatar. From Qatar, she couldn't travel on a tourist visa. She chose to go to Holland and is settling down there now. And of course, you know, you look at that and you think, wow, look at these children. They have found a life for themselves. But then she says, in the future, I will have grandchildren who speak Dutch, Swedish, and Spanish. If they don't learn Arabic, they will be strangers to each other. I mean, one hopes that they will not be. But there's the two generations, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And what you get a sense there is this scattering of the Syrian people. What we have today is a refugee crisis. Tomorrow it will be a huge far-flung diaspora. So it challenges us to imagine what will become of all the Syrians who've been displaced. How will they reconnect to each other? What will it even mean to be Syrian after those years pass?
Let me get Richard from Cranberry, New Jersey to join us. Hi, Richard. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. I volunteered in a Syrian refugee camp in Greece, the Ritsona camp, in the summer, and I was also in Onafita, which is another camp which was mainly Afghanis. Sadly, I believe that one closed down about a week ago. But I agree with everything that's been discussed. The refugees were absolutely wonderful people. Mm. Most of them were suffering from PTSD. I was involved with kids, adults. A lot of them were Kurds. But the question I've got is, first of all, I've learned that the U.S. has about 4,000 troops in Syria.
Richard, yeah, I hate to do this to you. It's a really bad phone line. If you can just ask your question, that would be great. I'm just afraid of losing you, but go ahead.
Yeah, my question is, what is the U.S. doing there? Because, and why are we there? Because we have 4,000 troops and about 10 military bases, seven of which are air bases. It's not revealed in the mainstream media. Mm. And I'd love to know, why are we there and what are we trying to achieve?
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Can you answer that, Wendy?
Well, I'm not sure I understood. Why are we there being, where's the there?
I think the there is Syria.
Oh, the there is Syria. Yeah, it's I'm not sure. I'm reading the news as you are, that there have been various sort of covert operations and projects, and I don't think we know the full extent of it. What I think we can say is whatever we're doing there has not been terribly effective in protecting civilians, in helping to bring about a political transition for which we've been calling for years. So it seems like that the kind of U.S. intervention that we've seen over the years, many of which I don't even know if we know the full story about, has maybe played a role in the perpetuation of the conflict. The war has gone on and on, but it has not achieved any goals of protecting lives or bringing about some sort of power sharing and a transition to a new kind of government that would protect and serve all Syrians.
We're almost out of time here, but I want to have you read two sections from Adam, who's a media organizer.
Right. So Adam said, one of the most profound things that I learned from this experience called the Syrian Civil War is this. Just because you're fighting evil doesn't mean you're good. And just because you're doing evil doesn't mean you're bad. You end up with the conclusion that there is no ultimate right or wrong. It's all shades of gray. We opened a Pandora's box. We had this innocent, childlike interest to see what was inside the box. We thought we'd get a present, and what we got was all the evil in the world. Now we need to close the box again, but it's going to take a while.
What does Adam mean? And again, we're almost out of time here.
So
profound.
Yeah, so Adam was someone who I supported the idea of an uprising against authoritarianism, and I think he's expressing the feeling that the revolution did not go the way that many revolutionaries hoped it would. And he goes on to say in this passage, you know, it's easy for you guys outside of Syria who enjoy the privilege of stable functioning institutions to look at over there in other countries and say, oh, look at those almost, you know, these barbarians who are killing each other. He said, this is what happens when the Pandora's box is opened, that we sometimes, he says, sometimes people do bad things in order to get a good system going. And this is the tragedy of Syria. It's a lot of bad things, but it began in the call for something right.
Well, Wendy Perlman, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you for bringing us these voices from Syria.
It was such a pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. And the book is called We Crossed a Bridge and It Trembled. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. And you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. You can also catch up with our guest. She'll be at Head House Books on Friday at 7:30. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.